is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome my good colleague, Jeff McCausland, Colonel, United States Army, retired artilleryman, CBS News, Dickinson College, visiting professor, CEO, Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, and my guide on the Gettysburg battlefield. There'll be much more to say about that in subsequent episodes, but I want to congratulate Jeff for having survived marching around with me, having never seen Gettysburg before. I kept up with him, and there'll be a video of us marching around. Jeff was very generous, and I thank him because we're leaving Gettysburg behind us, and we're going to war in the Ukraine, a much bigger battlefield. However, Jeff, that was wonderful, and thank you very much.
Well, John, it was a great pleasure and a wonderful day to have you on the battlefield finally, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
I go to Ukraine, where there's no clarity whatsoever. I do remark that the President of the United States in these last hours on Bloomberg TV and elsewhere is reporting that Vladimir Putin called him up and offered to help him with the Iran-Israel conflict. And Mr. Trump's remark was, I don't need any help with Iran-Israel. I need help with Russia. Why don't you settle the war? There was no conclusion but to the remark. But what it does indicate is that the two presidents are trash-talking each other. So, fine. It's not a sports contest. It's a war. And the burning fact that I picked up yesterday from reporting, Jeff, is that of a barrage, routinely now, barrages are incoming, Iskander missiles mixed with drones, that the day before there had been 8 Iskanders, 7 of them had hit their targets, civilian infrastructure, because they're low on Patriot missile system weapons. Low. And you've got a report that makes it even worse. What has the Pentagon said about supplying Ukraine? Good evening to you, Jeff.
Well, good evening, John. Well, Secretary of Defense Hicks has said today that there would be a pause in resupply of ammunition and supplies overall, military supplies overall to Ukraine. Now, he didn't specify exactly what that meant. Most people, myself included, would say that primarily will be 155 millimeter artillery shells and Patriot missiles. Now, it's interesting because during the NATO summit, Mr. Trump met with President Zelensky. And on the way back, it was pointed out to him, as I recall, by a newsman, the shortage of Patriot missiles that the Ukrainians were suffering from in their efforts to stop incoming Russian missiles. And Mr. Trump said, well, we're going to try to help them with that. Unclear if that meant military resupply as military aid or whether the United States was going to move ahead with sale. But again, there's a lot of pressure, particularly on air defense weapons, due to the fact that the United States supports not only Ukraine in its fight with the Russians, but also, of course, provided support to Israel in its efforts to thwart missile attacks by Iran. But you're quite right, John. You know, the largest combined strike in the entire war just occurred in the last few days, in which the Russians launched over 500 drones and missiles in one strike. Ukrainians were able to shoot down a little over half of those, and the focus does appear to be on civilian areas, predominantly a Russian effort, I think, to break the willpower of the Ukrainian people.
The FT out of London reporting that Russia is making successful advances in various parts of the battlefield. Is that your information, Jeff? Because it's been static for a long time.
It is mine as well, John. They're making steady but very slow progress at a very high level of casualties. They've launched a series of offensives, particularly in the direction of Sumy. This is the region of Ukraine in which the Ukrainians launched their offensive into Kursk region, you may recall. Now, the Russians drove them out, and there now seems to be an effort by the Russian military to establish a buffer zone in that area. There's about 50,000 Russian troops involved in that offensive alone. Furthermore, it appears now that the Russians can claim that they have now got complete control of the Luhansk Oblast, Luhansk province, and about 70% of the control of Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. Those are the three other oblasts that Russia has claimed. But finally, John, I think it's interesting to me that Mr. Putin, in statements on the 20th of June during a St. Petersburg economic conference, and then as late as 30 June, has reiterated a goal by Russia of occupying what appears to be all of Ukraine, at least to the eastern bank of the Dnipro River, and furthermore may even have the objective of occupying all of Ukraine. Mr. Putin, Medvedev, Lavrov, the foreign minister, using discussions of so-called Nova Russia, talking about how Russia and Ukraine are one people, one culture. So it seems their rhetoric and the military efforts now, John, are to seize as much territory as possible. And there's no indication I can see of any interest on the Russian side for serious negotiations about bringing this war to a ceasefire.
The Middle East, the Iran-Israel exchange of attacks, Iran with missiles and drones, Israel with aircraft, we're told, and drones. And then the United States entered the picture with the B-2s and the F-35s and the Ohio-class missile boat firing cruise missiles into Isfahan, I believe. The president has remarked that the situation is a ceasefire. So far, the ceasefire is held. I do not see any indication that it's going to break down, but there's said to be negotiations. I've missed out on that part. I don't believe they've started. What is the goal that you understand these negotiations would want to achieve?
Well, the goals would be to try to create some kind of a nuclear settlement with the Iranians, which was the effort Mr. Trump was trying to accomplish prior to the onset of the attack by the Israelis and the subsequent involvement by the United States. But best of my knowledge, Mr. Trump said negotiations were going to begin next week, and he said that last week. Those have not formally begun. Steve Witkoff, his principal negotiator, my best of my ability, has not met with the Iranians, though I think he may have spoken to them by telephone since the United States committed that attack. But I think what that particular negotiation would seek to do is verify Iranian compliance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, allow IAEA inspectors then to inspect facilities, to see what damage was done. So far, the Iranians have halted all cooperation with the IAEA in the aftermath of the attack, account for the 800-plus pounds of enriched uranium we know they have, and then seek some agreement that would eliminate, or if not limit, Iran's ability to enrich uranium in return for a reduction in economic sanctions. Whether or not the Iranian political leadership is willing to pursue that type of negotiation now is just unclear, John.
The remarks about the suspect nuclear weapons program being set back weeks, months, years, there's a lot of rhetoric surrounding it. My information over the years and talking to people worried about proliferation is once a country has nuclear power, it's up to the country whether they're going to move towards a bomb or not. In other words, this is about intentions, not about facts on the ground. You start with a nuclear power and a plant, and you can find your way to a plutonium or enriched uranium bomb eventually, especially secretly, which is what North Korea did, and we believe what Iran is suspect of. So, Jeff, I do not see any diminution in the intention of Iran to be a hostile power in the region. Do you?
It's unclear, John, to me. And the foreign minister did acknowledge that Iran had been severely damaged. We know even prior to that, Iran was suffering grievously from economic downturns. They even had routine electric blackouts. There were strikes by truck drivers. So a lot of economic pressure on the Iranian people. Now, whether in the aftermath, the leadership, which number one wants to stay in power, can galvanize public support to continue to pour resources into now recovering its nuclear capabilities after they were destroyed, at least as far as enrichment goes, that remains to be seen. Or whether popular demand now will force the leadership to seek some kind of an alternative that might then, with an agreement, provide them some degree of economic relief. But at this point, it's unclear which direction Iran will go to. And it really may be a function of the Grand Ayatollah, who is 86 years old, and it seems to me, at least based on his rhetoric before, during, and after the attack, that I doubt as long as he is in power that Iran will move towards negotiations. Pezeshkian, the president, has said that this is an opportunity for Iran. So I think this juggling of leadership positions in Iran and how that turns out may be an indicator of whether Iran decides we want to now move towards accommodation with the West, better relations, and perhaps better economic security, or the Iranian leadership says, no, now we must race to get a weapon, provide us a deterrent so the Israelis and the Americans won't attack us again.
Hamas, a surrogate of Iran, but at the same time, a longtime opponent of the Jerusalem government. And right now, the president has said, President Trump has said, that there is an offer by Israel for a ceasefire, which would involve the cessation of hostilities in the Gaza Strip, in exchange for, we can believe, the remaining hostages, dead and alive. There's been no, that I can see reporting, there's been no response from Hamas. This is a positive development. I add one more. I learned yesterday from a conversation with a reporter that there is reason to believe that Egypt and Jordan will offer their services to govern the Gaza in the rebuilding moments, where whatever that's going to take over years. I don't know whether that includes police power. I don't know whether that means they'll tolerate Hamas. Do you have any information about what happens after the war ends?
No, none whatsoever, John, except for the fact that we have conflicting final objectives for Hamas and for Israel. Now, there may be a 60-day ceasefire. The president's talking about that. And in that particular 60 days, there would be about half of the hostages who are still living would be released. We believe there are about 20 still living. And some of the remains of hostages who have died in captivity, we believe there are about 30 of those, would be released by Hamas while negotiations are ongoing to end the conflict. And that always is the rub, because their ultimate objectives are so conflicted. On the Israeli side, they have continued to say the total destruction of Hamas and the exodus of any leaders who do survive from Gaza is an Israeli goal. Hamas, on the other side, has sought an end to the war and a full withdrawal of the Israeli Defense Forces from Gaza. Those are totally incompatible. Now, there are some suggestion, and some believe, Mr. Netanyahu now may believe, that because of his boost in popularity domestically on the attack on Iran, he may be in a better position to call for a new election that may allow him to create a cabinet that's not so dependent on the extreme right wing of the Israeli political spectrum, that could allow him perhaps to accommodate from those objectives. It'll be interesting, of course, John, because Mr. Netanyahu is due to arrive in the United States right after the 4th of July. That'll be his third visit to the United States this year. And we'll have to wait and see what comes out of that in terms of discussing a ceasefire and perhaps an end to the conflict.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired artilleryman, CBS News, Dickinson College visiting professor. We turn to NATO. Jeff's a veteran of NATO. And some considerations were made at the meeting at The Hague that can be profound for the balance of this century. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.